Hey everybody, Kevin Rose here. Welcome back to another episode of the Block Zero podcast. Today's guest is going to be awesome, and I'm excited about this show because it checks all of my boxes, my excitement boxes when it comes to cryptocurrency. The first one being that I'm looking for really novel thinking. So original ideas, taking on really tough problems. And Solana, the cryptocurrency we're talking about, is certainly one of those projects. When you go to their website, one of the things that you'll notice is they talk about this idea of transactions per second. And if you're into the cryptocurrency space, you'll know things like, you know, Bitcoin doing 7 transactions per second, Ethereum doing 14 transactions per second. And some, you know, when we start comparing that to real world kind of like enterprise applications such as Visa doing 65,000 transactions per second, or Google Ads doing 344,000 transactions per second. Or on the very high end, you have something like NASDAQ, which is doing 500,000 transactions per second. So you can see when you're talking about Bitcoin at 7 or Ethereum at 14, I mean, this is like orders of magnitudes difference from where something like a NASDAQ is performing. And so it's one of the big problems that we have in the cryptocurrency world, especially when it comes to smart contracts, is in terms of execution speed. And so, you know, a lot of these projects are going off chain. They're saying, well, a lot of this doesn't have to be done on chain. We can just take it off chain and do the computation on the side and then come back and do all the settlement on chain. And I think that's a good solution, but it's the total opposite approach of what Solana is saying and actually doing, which is crazy. They're saying, no. It's just, it hasn't been coded the right way. All this can be done on chain, and they are claiming that they can hit 710,000 transactions per second, which is nuts. And so when I first sat down with the CEO here about 6 months ago, I was, of course, intrigued. And so the CEO's name is Anatoly Yakovenko, and he was at our office at True Ventures in San Francisco. We sat down and we started chatting. And oftentimes, you know, I've probably taken 50, maybe 100 different cryptocurrency related pitches, you know, being in venture capital and being an investor in this space. And I would say that 9 times out of 10, it is a very excited team, but they don't necessarily have the team and the chops to pull off very big, ambitious ideas, which isn't to say that they can't build projects that are successful. But when you're talking about something that scales to, you know, 700,000 plus transactions per second, clearly you have to know what you're doing, and you're doing something very different than everyone else. So Anatoly has a really amazing background. He's a Qualcomm engineer. Qualcomm, of course, we all know, mobile chipset company. Back in the day, he worked on kernel development there. And kernel development, obviously, the really low-level development, it's where the most hardcore engineers work. And he worked on an OS there called Brew. Now, you probably have never heard of Brew, but it was actually the behind-the-scenes operating system that powered every CDMA flip phone. So we're talking like, you know, the old Motorola Razors and things like that. 100 million plus devices. So he was a performance engineer there working on like low level operating system work, and then went off to work at Dropbox, working on compression. So needless to say, when we get in this conversation, if you're lost due to all the technical jargon and the different things that he's talking about, you're not the only one. I was also lost several times during this conversation. Anatoly is clearly a just brilliant prodigy when it comes to this stuff. So we sat down, we started talking about this about 6 months ago. He got me so excited with the team that he was building, and also the how ambitious this idea was, that I invested. So I always like to disclose that. So I did put some of my own personal money into his project. And now he's gotten a lot further along. He actually has a test net that is launched, and he's proven out, I believe, a little over 600,000 transactions per second. This is really compelling stuff and could potentially be a very large cryptocurrency project. So I wanted to get it in front of you, let you listen to Anatoly, hear what he's up to. And then, at the end, we talk about ways that you can get involved. There's going to be a whole bit of mining associated with this. You can join their Telegram. Obviously, this is not investment advice. just because I personally invested doesn't mean that you should. But you should listen to this interview and get a sense of what's going on in this world in terms of what he's doing differently, because it's really exciting on a whole slew of different levels. So hope you enjoyed the conversation. This is Anatoly Yakovenko. Well, thanks for joining me on the show. I'm excited to have you. This is going to be a really, I have a feeling it's going to be a really geeky conversation, because you have a really kind of exciting new whole cryptocurrency that I was blown away by the first time we had a conversation about this. But I think a good place to start would be just to kind of introduce yourself and tell us a little bit about your background and how you got started in this space.
Cool. Thank you, Kevin. Yeah, I'm super excited to be here as well. So a little bit about myself. I am, just a plain old engineer, went to school at Urbana-Champaign, studied computer science, ended up working at Qualcomm for about 12 years. So there I spend most of my time working in operating systems. If you guys ever had a flip phone, this will definitely date me a bit, like a CDMA flip phone, like a Motorola Razr or something like that. So yeah, I was on the core kernel team. The OS that ran those things was called Brew. So it wasn't really advertised as Brew, like we have Android right now. Qualcomm right. built it for OEMs, which at the time sold it to Verizon or other like carriers that had very specific requirements about what a phone should look like. And Apple kind of totally changed the model and blew that whole space away. And in a matter of 4 months, the market went from 80% feature phones to 20% feature phones. This is really crazy.
That is crazy.
Up until that point, it was a super fun project. And I really learned how to build operating systems there, because we were building for a huge number of different devices. Like, I think at the end, we had 1600 different pieces of hardware that ran this thing, anywhere from 4 megabytes of RAM to, something like 64 megabytes of RAM, which were the tail end, latest and greatest Brew phones. So we had to really design this thing with thinking about every possible constraint and every possible optimization, while still having a platform where developers could, build applications on. And it actually had 2 billion app downloads before the iPhone had one, right? So it was fairly successful, even though kind of a quiet project in terms of publicity that both Android and an iPhone have.
One of the things I was always curious about back in those days is there was no really easy way to update the software, right? So it's how it must have been a really scary thing to say, okay, we're done with this release, let's ship it, and it's going to get pre-installed on all these devices. What if you did something wrong? What if there was a major bug or some kind of security vulnerability? How did you address that type of stuff?
Oh man, that was, so we had plans for all of this. We actually had code that was dynamically updatable. It was all in modules. You could actually download different modules for just about every part of the software. But all the other people in this manufacturing pipeline didn't have those logistics, because from their perspective, taking a piece of an application and updating that required the same amount of testing to satisfy the FCC requirements as reflashing the entire OS. So really nothing, it was very hard to get things updated over the air, like we do now with Android or iOS, applications even, right? But we had plans for all of that. And effectively, unless it was a serious security vulnerability, you really didn't update anything.
Yeah, I don't remember there being any kind of software updates for my Motorola Razr or anything like that.
Yeah, yeah. It was possible. All that stuff was definitely possible. And internally, we had kind of all the engineering worked out for this. And we were engineers. We were coding, a few years ahead of where the market was. I mean, even that phone market now, it takes you build your software now, a year later, it's actually out. That's a really long timeline for any software project.
Yeah. One of the things, given the constraints back in the day, you said as low as 4 megabytes?
Yep.
I just think about when I'm flashing, or downloading a new iOS version and it's a couple gigs or whatever it may be.
Yeah.
It's how do you get an entire operating system in 4 megabytes. I mean, obviously they used to do it back in the day, like when I was installing, you know, DOS on my computer, it was like a couple floppy disks. But did you have to really be thoughtful and refactor different things to condense it down that small to fit within that space?
Part of the strategy there was that, just making things smaller. But another part was really like making everything optional. Like we had very carefully designed this OS to be really composable out of a bunch of smaller pieces. And that means that every piece was kind of independent and could be plugged in, and everything dynamically discovers everything and then boots up. So that was really the strategy that we took. And the kernel itself, we could get down to like 160 kilobytes, I think. That was our lowest possible, I think, footprint. That was really cool. But the whole OS, right, pulls in a bunch of images, a bunch of like applications and all that stuff. And the more of this stuff you pull in, the bigger it blows up. So that, like with Android and iOS, you're really downloading. What we think of operating systems now isn't really what like people thought of them, like operating system class kind of designers, like out of school. You think of the OS as the kernel, and you're really working on like scheduling, memory management, and a few really core pieces to make everything else work. Now, like you think of the OS and you think of all the applications that go along with it. Like, is the phone app really part of the OS? You know, like it's just an application, but we think of that as being very so integrated to the OS that it's really a part of it now.
Right.
And like Microsoft really changed this trend by like integrating Explorer into their operating system, kind of making it not functional without it, which is an interesting approach. But I think for operating systems, the goal is to give developers the best platform to build. And if it means that applications that are critical for users are now more integrated, I think that's where the trend will go.
Yeah. I like that even Apple now these days is allowing you to uninstall some of the default applications, which I think is a great move.
Yep. Back in the day, Bitcoin was kind of this new thing. And when it was still CPU mining, I played around with it a little bit. And I thought, huh, this is an interesting way to do consensus, but it'll never scale. So nobody will ever use it, right? Engineers make the worst investment decisions. Like we look at the tech and like, if we can't see it working for a large number of users, they're like, oh, this will never be interesting to anyone. And same thing with Ethereum. Bitcoin kind of blew up and this whole Mt. Gox thing happened and it still didn't go away. So it seemed like, oh yeah, this thing is really sticky now. Like we're actually going to have cryptocurrencies. And Ethereum was this like really innovative approach to not only doing transactions, but actually running applications. And when I looked at it, I was like, oh, this is like a really hacked up version of JavaScript. Why would anyone want to use this? Right?
Yeah.
But their accomplishment was actually building something that works. Right. And that is an enormous achievement. Like it seems very easy to like look at and nitpick on technical decisions. But when you're the first out the door and you actually build something that a lot of people use, that is like kind of the 90% of the work in my mind. And now I think after so many years of like looking at the space from the outside, I'm a performance kind of optimization expert. That's what I did for 12 years at Qualcomm. Now, like, I feel like I can actually contribute and build something that is both as general as Ethereum, but also super, super fast. And so I'm very, very excited to be a part of it.
Yeah. Before we jump into the actual project, you were also an engineer at Dropbox. Is that right? Where you worked on compression?
I was lucky enough to be on the file system team, and this was half side project. We were really trying to do some experimental compression like implementations there. And the team was very successful building JPEG compression. I think the middle out compression thing from Piper was in some ways, I think, inspired by this project because they interviewed some of the people working on this way back when. So why Dropbox would be interested in compression is because if we can compress things, it takes less hard drives, and that's like a direct dollar savings. We were building some really wacky attempts to use machine learning as a general purpose, kind of like if you have a way to predict what the structure of the file you're you're compressing, you can use those predictions to reduce how much space you need to store a bit. So you're effectively storing fractional bits. If that makes any sense to anyone. You're using these techniques called arithmetic coding, where you can use a smaller amount of integer space, or like effectively a fractional amount of space to store bits. And the fraction depends on how good your predictor is. So if you're able to predict with 99% accuracy what the next bit is going to be, you can use roughly 99% fewer bits. That makes sense. Hmm. Because you look at your predictor and it tells you, oh, the next bit is going to be a one. So you use a fractional bit to store that it's a one. So when you're wrong, you pay a big price. But when you're right, you're effectively using your predictor to generate this.
So I'd love to hear about this project. Tell me what got you excited. What was the turning point for you where you were like, okay, this is a big idea. I know I can go tackle it. And how does all this learning and expertise that you have at Qualcomm and Dropbox and other companies apply to what you're doing today?
So I kind of really started thinking about this problem last summer when I saw that scaling is definitely a problem. Like people were really complaining about it and saying, Ethereum, Bitcoin roughly do about 7 transactions per second, theoretical maximum. I think Ethereum might be 11, but basically the same number. And if you have a population of people that each person does 3 transactions per day, that would effectively serve a population the size of Berkeley. So as a technology, it's very limited to the number of people it can support, like for day-to-day payments. For value store and other kind of doing real estate transfers, it might be fine, but to be a worldwide payment system, it's not going to work. And a lot of really interesting approaches started popping up. Some like very clever user cryptography, like Lightning Network. And the one that really got me thinking about this was IOTA. They had this like really crazy DAG, which effectively is your transactions are part of this tree that's ever branching and growing, and then activity kind of pulls everything back together. And the reason I looked at it is because they were claiming they could do IoT, and me coming from embedded systems, I was like, oh, let me look at this. I was like, this will never scale. This will never actually work on an embedded device, was my opinion. But they just really started my brain thinking about how do we actually make this work. And eventually I got so interested in the space that I decided, okay, it's now or never. There seems to be a lot of projects that are building really interesting things. I have a lot of experience that I can contribute. So I decided to leave Dropbox, which was really hard to do because they have the most amazing food out of any company I've worked with.
Amazing food?
I'm very, very easy to keep me happy. It's just give me awesome
food. I've heard engineers being wooed by a whole slew of different benefits. Never has the number one been the food, but that's interesting. I've never eaten at Dropbox. I should pay it a visit, I guess.
Their program is run by a Michelin star chef who make like amazing French pastries like every day, and like basically just the most awesome food I've had at any company.
That's funny. Yeah. Yeah, we had some pretty decent food at Google, and I was lucky enough to work in the same building as Larry and Sergey, or at least as Larry, not as Sergey. But he had a special floor that was off limits to anyone outside the building. So Google was very open about all of their different cafeterias being open to anyone on campus. And there was 2 exceptions to that. One was the Android building, which was a great sushi restaurant that you had to have a certain clearance for. And the other one was Larry's building. And so I was lucky enough to be on Larry's building, and I would go to that cafeteria, and it was just like kind of similar thing where you could tell that the chefs that he had hired for his personal cafeteria were, a few notches above everybody else. So yeah. I had the benefit of being able to have some amazing, it was mostly vegan food, but it was pretty, pretty phenomenal for vegan food. It's the kind of vegan food that you eat and you're just like, there's no way this doesn't have meat. Like, it's surprising that it's even vegan.
Awesome.
And that's, it was pretty great. But yeah, I did make use of all the great perks back in the day.
Yeah, that's awesome. I'll have to find a friend at Google to get me in there if that's possible.
Yeah, you got to do a little comparison.
Yep. So yeah, I left and started really really doing like, you know, design, doing the thing I'm good at. And eventually I got into this idea that how to solve performance problems in this large distributed system is with time. And I looked at Intel's SGX platform, which is a way to give you this thing called proofs of elapsed time, but you have to trust the Intel hardware enclave. And trust in a permissionless network is problematic because you're effectively creating a permission network where if there's a hack into SGX, then the whole thing falls apart. That doesn't really work in crypto. And the reason I was thinking about time is because while I was at Qualcomm, my last project was really getting third-party developers to use these digital signal processors, which are these additional cores running on a chip, on a Qualcomm chip. So your modern-day phone is actually like not like one CPU. It's about 20 or 30 different CPUs all shrunk in the same die. And they all talk to each other. And the way they talk to each other is very similar to how computers talk in a network. They send messages. So one of the benefits of in that system is that we have a clock that's routed to all the subsystems that we can trust. When you have this clock, you can timestamp all the messages. And when they arrive out of order and all the different CPUs on this die, you can order them based on the timestamp and you always get the same order on all the different CPUs.
Is that done at the millisecond level? Like how are you timestamping that?
So the clock is very high resolution. There's a couple different clocks and some can give you like basically like near cycle speed resolution. So that depends on the CPU clock itself. But yeah, it's sub millisecond effectively. So because you have this centralized clock, things you can solve a lot of problems fairly easily that way. But we don't have the centralized clock. And we have the other option was SGX. And eventually I kind of thought, well, you could just do this like generate time, right? You can use a data structure that represents time passing in the system. Because when you look at if you look at the Bitcoin ledger, the definition of the network is that the difficulty is set such that given all the hash power in the network, roughly every 10 minutes somebody solves the puzzle. So if every 10 minutes a block is added to Bitcoin, this set of blocks represents a data structure that when you look at, you can say, okay, there's 100 blocks, so 100 times 10, 1,000 minutes passed. So that is a form of keeping track of time, if that makes sense.
It does, but how does it increase in hash power? Like if you were to have, is that a way to manipulate this? Would be to increase your hash power and decrease the time it takes to actually solve that problem?
Bitcoin does this automatically. If blocks are found too frequently, the difficulty goes up. So then it's harder to find a block and it roughly stays around every 10 minutes.
Gotcha.
But that is, so the distinction there is that is a form of time after consensus, because we already agreed on what the chain looks like. And this set of blocks represents time, but time that is already agreed upon by the network. So what we're doing is a way to keep track of time before consensus. And that means that in all partitions of the network, time is passing at equal rates, roughly. So how this thing works is that the technical term or academic term is a verifiable delay function. But I didn't even know what these things were in November when I kind of came up with this. Basically, I looked at how Bitcoin works and I simplified it by taking the function that Bitcoin uses for its puzzle, a SHA-256. This is a cryptographic hash function with this property called pre-image resistance. And what that means is that you can't take a bunch of data and construct it in such a way to get a specific output out. You have to actually brute force this, and it requires like 2 to the 128 number of attempts. So you need a very large, effectively it's impossible given current computers. So this property means that if I take this cryptographic hash function and take its output and use it as the next input and do this as fast as I can over and over again, the result a million hashes from now is unpredictable. There's no way for me to like shortcut it. I actually have to run this a million times. So if I sample this process and kind of record the hash, let's say every 100,000 iterations, this set of samples, this data structure represents time passing. So this data structure kind of grows like a water clock. In this water clock, when I receive this data structure, I can examine it and know how much time has passed. And it doesn't matter. No consensus has been done yet, but I know that in the structure, you know, 10 minutes passed or, you know, 10 years. It doesn't matter, right? But I can look at it and verify it. And the cool thing is that I can take each sample and look at basically a slice. So, you know, sample 10 and then sample 11 represents one slice. And then I can use a core to run from the start to the finish of the slice and verify it. And I can do all of this in parallel. So a modern day GPU card with 4,000 cores can verify a second worth of samples in a quarter millisecond, which has a very nice asymmetric property. So how our system actually uses this is that not only are we using the structure for keeping track of time, but also this is in fact our ledger. So when messages are received, we take the messages and we hash them and take the hash of those messages and append them to the hash of this loop that's iterating. And we record the count and the hash that we appended. So now our data structure has these hashes that it gets stuck into it. And when you do this append, you change the input. And that means you're modifying all the subsequent outputs in an unpredictable way. Mm-hmm. So now this guarantees that this input occurred sometime before the next output, because there's no way for you to have guessed the next output. You actually have to append it and then modify it. And now you have this random 256-bit number that represents that, like in this point in time, something, you know, happened. So what's cool about this is that inside the messages, we can also reference hashes that they've observed from this clock. And these hashes, because they're kind of pointing back to this structure, represent the lower bound of when this message could have occurred. Because there's no way for you to have guessed this 256-bit number, right? You observe it, you record it into your message, and then you put the message back into this chain, which modifies all the subsequent numbers. So now you have this upper and lower bound in time. To kind of like put it another way, I have a newspaper, the New York Times, and I take a photo of myself with that New York Times. And that proves that I was alive sometime after New York Times published the story. So then I take this photo and I send it to the New York Times and they publish that. So now there's proof of me existing before and after those publications, right? Mm-hmm. So that is effectively what we're doing. So none of this really has anything to do with consensus. All this does is create a record that has the property of time passing and order.
What can that record contain? What type of information can it contain? So like if I'm trying to, for me, I understand very clearly if I'm sending, you know, Bitcoin from one user to another, how that is stored on the blockchain. Like how is that data and how do you do a lookup against past transactions in your world?
What those messages represent is modification of the state. So the state is another way to call it is it's a virtual machine and it has a bunch of state. When you send a message, you're doing an operation, like an instruction in the virtual machine. And that instruction could be move money from account A to account B. And when those instructions are added into this thing we're calling proof of history, when they're added to the proof of history, the historical record indicates how I should modify the state machine. And when I get to the end, that's the final state.
And will there be a way to use an explorer to like look and browse through this?
Oh yeah, definitely. Yeah, that should work very similar to how Ethereum works and most other blockchains.
Now, one of the things that it would just blew me away, and I would say that most people are going to be skeptical of in terms of what you're creating is, you know, right on the front page of the website, you know, we're all familiar with the issues with processing time and number of transactions per second, and you know, some of the scaling challenges, or I should say, all of the scaling challenges that everyone is facing these days. You make the claim of 710,000 transactions a second. That's not like a 2 or 3x of others.
100,000x, and this is on a 1 gigabit network. If we had a bigger network, we could scale it a bit more. To say that on a 40 gigabit, we can do, I don't know, what is it, 28 million transactions per second or something like that, it would take a lot of work.
Well, let's take a real world example of, like, let's just say in this world, do people run nodes? First of all, I guess, like, how does the average consumer contribute to the network?
Why we can scale that much is because we're generating this data structure that represents time. We can insert a bunch of data into this thing and propagate it through the network. And when nodes receive this data structure, they recreate it and they can process and verify the time part of it. And then when they look at the events, they can trust the time and order of those events relative to each other without observing them directly. So that means that me as a node in the network, I get this proof of a historical record because I can verify that the record is actually a proof of time passing. I can then look at the messages in that record and know that these messages occurred a year ago and these messages occurred, like, you know, 2 seconds ago. And I've never actually had to witness them directly. Like, I'm just downloading this data. It's almost like, you know, observing light from a distant star. We know that that star exists, even though we don't actually, like, we haven't visited it, but we can see the light, right?
Right.
So because of this, nodes don't have to communicate to each other about time and order of events. They simply look at this data structure and approve the entire structure. And when they do this approval, that is itself a vote to confirm the transactions in the structure that gets put in back into the structure as a transaction. So now I am, as a node in this network, I'm observing everyone else's votes in the structure, but not directly, right? They don't have to go through me. I simply observe them as they're getting downloaded into this proof of history. And that saves on the messaging overhead in the network. Effectively, like, nodes don't have to talk to each other unless we have a partition. That allows us to scale to network speeds. Is that making any sense at all?
No, it is. Okay. So you're saying that they can independently, they're essentially just trust it doesn't have to rely on other nodes. And if that's the case, then why would they even need to communicate to begin with?
Yep.
So how does the data propagate then between, how do you get the latest, you know, version of the ledger?
As a node in the network, there's actually several problems, like in building a high performance network. One is just solving this communication part. The other one is that storage becomes a massive issue. So as a node on the network, if you're a new node, you have to download the entire ledger and verify it. Now, if we are actually at full capacity, that's 5 petabytes of data a year. We don't expect every node to store everything, and we can partition that structure effectively, kind of like a peer-to-peer storage network amongst all the nodes in the network. So if everyone throws in a terabyte, that terabyte can kind of store the entire thing, right, in part.
How do you partition that? I mean, that has to be a whole nother set of challenges. Are you using something like IPFS, or how are you figuring out how to partition that data?
So because we have a way to keep track of time in the network, we can do very cheap to verify proofs of replication. And then you can use these proofs to have nodes in the network provide storage and prove that they're storing a bit of this public data set that should be available to everybody effectively. So the reason we can do cheap proofs of replication is because if you have a way to keep track of time, instead of generating a whole new proof every time, you can simply sample your data structure that represents your copy of the ledger.
I see.
And when you sample this faster than it takes to generate the proof, then you can guarantee that it still exists and you're not cheating. So that's kind of our trick there. And that allows us to coalesce all the samples at once and verify them all in parallel on a bunch of CUDA cores. So luckily, we're like One of my co-founders spent 10 years working on GPUs at Qualcomm, so we're utilizing GPUs heavily for useful things.
Is Q1 of next year still the planned launch for the mainnet?
That is the plan. So we should be at full functionality by that time. Right now we have an alpha testnet out, so that's 50 nodes. We're building this dashboard that monitors our performance kind of network. And that is a bunch of like 50 nodes running in Google Cloud that are constantly getting hammered. And Google keeps sending us notices that we're doing a denial of service. So we're that's part of our challenge here. But in that mode, it peaks at about 670,000 transactions per second, which is pretty close to the theoretical maximum. And that's awesome, I think, wow, for an engineer.
So, take me to, let's pretend everything goes to plan and the mainnet launches come Q1 next year. What does that look like in terms of use cases? Like, what's going to be, and how will the average consumer that's listening to this show, you know, how will they interact with the platform? It sounds like, you know, when you mentioned like Google Cloud hosting some of these nodes, some of the storage requirements, like will the average consumer be able to fire up their GPU and participate in some way? And if so, you know, and you get into more of a world where it is consumer machines and consumer hardware contributing to the network that don't have dedicated, you know, gigabit connections between nodes, does that then lower the transactions per second? And what does that world look like?
So our goal is to get consumer hardware as the platform. Our test machine is a $5,000 machine. It's off-the-shelf hardware with four NVIDIA 1080 Ti's. And that's more than enough to do everything. That's like excessively enough. So we're targeting something that anyone can purchase. And if that sounds expensive, in 2 years, that machine will cost $2,500, right? I think the prices will drop much faster than we can fill the capacity. Because I think if you look at all the active use cases on Ethereum right now, I think it doesn't add up to 300 daily active users. So we're still in like the infancy of the space. And my belief is that we'll see that number blow up exponentially as soon as the scaling problems are solved. Because when you can build on a platform that is like unhackable and can send money between applications like completely frictionlessly, I think that is a very powerful combination.
Is this something that consumers are going to be able to mine? Like, what will the underlying currency look like?
Because one of the problems is storing a large amount of data if we're actually at capacity, or even, you know, even at like, you know, 50,000 transactions per second, that's I think about a petabyte of data a year. It's quite a lot of data. We don't want a network to be a centralized network where only the nodes that can store that much data can participate. Regular consumers can have a bunch of hard drives, you know, terabyte or so, that they can contribute to just storing the ledger itself without doing any of the transactional verification. So if you don't have access to 1 gigabit network or whatever the speed is, given the current capacity requirements, then you could simply provide storage. And that's fairly easy to get going.
And then will you be rewarded for providing that storage?
Yeah. So this is kind of our supercomputer strung together with, like, you know, storage running on home connections and GPUs running on, you know, on home connections, like commodity GPUs. It's very interesting to think about that could be strung together with software to be an incredibly reliable and high performance system.
And then how does the actual mining itself work? Is it proof of work, or is it proof of stake, or what did you land on there?
It's proof of stake. So when the nodes receive this historical record, they do a proof of stake type verification, which is effectively a bet of their stake that this is the record that everybody else has agreed upon, and I'm going to agree with this record as well.
And they're staking and locking up currency at that point?
Yep. And storage miners are simply providing proofs of storage, and they get a reward based on that. So there is you don't have to have capital to receive a reward. You can simply add storage to the network.
Crazy. This is exciting. When can people, so based on the AlphaNet today, can they go and do some test mining and things like that, or is that not yet functioning?
Mining is not yet functioning. So our target for both the developer SDK for smart contracts and mining is September-ish. So we're busy executing on that. So yeah, I'm excited to be able to have people mine and actually submit smart contract code, untrusted code from whoever else, right, on the internet, and see how this thing behaves. Those are like the super fun operating system challenges, because you're really like relying on the software to sandbox everything without a huge performance hit.
Yeah, I'm curious what you mentioned smart contracts as being something that you're going to go off and I guess add to the platform over time, and it's on your website as well. What are the kind of order for which you roll out these different features, and then what are some of the use cases that you would see? I mean, obviously there's been a lot of issues with smart contracts in terms of like the time to execute them, and there's this will solve a lot of that. What other use cases do you see there being for this?
So our goal with smart contracts is to actually be as fast as transactions. So the transactions are implemented as they're very kind of bare bones smart contracts. You could do, 700,000 contract, operations per second potentially. That is like really, really cool that nobody else I think is building. And why I think that's really, really cool is that you can now imagine interactive games that are happening entirely on chain. So you and I could play chess and all the actual moves can happen on chain without like actually like being slow.
Right? See, that's the thing that's so confusing about this project, I think, at least for me, and I'm sure a lot of other people, is like you have the last year and a half of everyone in the industry talking about moving things off chain, to really like
right.
to solve some of these issues. And you're saying, no, actually let's put it all on chain. That's such a weird thing to say these days.
Modern day hardware is insanely fast. Like 1480 Ti's is 14,000 cores. Like, can you imagine that? Like, why aren't we using all of them? Like, that is like a very simple question. Like, if we actually use all of them, we can do a lot of things in parallel. That's our goal, and we're pretty close to proving that everything is going to work. Super excited about that. So once everything is on chain, why wouldn't you build everything on chain? Like, you have a supercomputer that cannot be like destroyed by a meteor, right? Versus yeah. like stringing together a bunch of like websites and like different states and stuff like that. Like, to me, this seems like a very natural move forward. I think some of the kind of cloud providers are moving into a similar, conceptually similar ideas that like Lambda and all these other platforms allow you to execute only on demand. So while, like people argue that, oh, AWS is always going to be cheaper, but generally when you do an AWS deployment, you're paying for persistent state, like a persistent machine to run there and service requests.
Sure.
If you do things on chain, your contract only executes when there's a transaction going to it. So it only like that execution is only necessary when you pay for it. So a very rough and kind of dumb guesstimate of the cost per transaction is, take what the Bitcoin miners are making today per second and divide it by 700,000. So that should roughly be somewhere between 10 to the minus 5 to 10 to the minus $6 per transaction.
Wow, crazy.
So if you have $10, that's a million transactions, right? For $10, you can have a million users like poke at your on-chain contract.
That's insane.
So there's really like price-wise, I think it's competitive to Heroku, right?
Yeah.
I think that's like a no-brainer then. And I'm excited to see what developers will build in these like interactive like on-chain programs that require really no off-chain state.
Yeah, it's interesting to think about how with AWS and these other services, you are paying for the actual hardware, whether you use it or not, paying for like the full capacity, the potential capacity of that hardware, even if it's not fully being utilized. And here you're saying it's kind of a more on demand, right? Like it scales up as you need it in real time.
Yeah, there's limits, obviously, right? Because we're still, as a blockchain that it does no sharding, we're limited by the slowest node in the supermajority for that time period. So however long it takes for the slowest node to confirm the final supermajority of the staking, that's going to be kind of our throughput and finality limits. But our $5,000 machine and a 1 gigabit network can do, 700,000 transactions per second. So we feel that the network will be fast, like much faster than anything else out today. And we can actually reward nodes that respond faster. So there should be this economic incentive to continuously upgrade.
Oh, interesting. So you're looking at how quickly they're able to respond.
Yep.
And then they will receive a larger upgrade depending on their hardware performance.
Yeah, exactly.
So yeah, I'm looking at some of the comparables here. Google, for example, 344,000 ads per second is what they serve. NASDAQ does about 500,000 transactions a second. So that you basically could run NASDAQ and still have some overhead in theory, which is kind of crazy.
Yeah, NASDAQ does have very, very fast confirmation. So when you're co-located and you have like, 0.5 meter Ethernet cable to your machine, you can get, I think sub 10 millisecond finality for your trades.
Are they doing fiber between machines? How do they get that?
I can only speculate, but I imagine it's extremely optimized.
Yeah, exactly.
Right? When there's money involved, I'm sure it gets really optimized. For us, I think our goal is sub 0.5 second. I think that's achievable with a lot of work. So that would be, I think, fast enough for users to actually use on-chain stuff in real time. But I don't think we can get to kind of NASDAQ level performance.
So one last question for you. I'm just really curious about where you see this going, 5 years from now, kind of like the bigger overarching vision for where you plan on taking this. Like I know that smart contracts and adding that to the mix is going to be obviously a pretty massive undertaking. And getting that working. But what other use cases would you say that you would imagine that this will help people with?
We've been open source from day one, and I'm just really excited about building an open source community around this. Like, that takes years to do, and I'm excited to see what this will become if we're successful in 5 years. So we have like a large, thriving open source community. Like, I wish it would to be as awesome as Linux, like the Linux kernel, right? Like, this is the kernel for this decentralized space. So that's my dream. In terms of what we accomplish, I think one interesting aspect is that a lot of these scaling solutions, especially like Lightning and all this off-chain stuff, throws away the data. And we're actually storing it. And based on my kind of back in the envelope calculations, the storage is fairly cheap. It's $150,000 of hard drives for a petabyte. So you split that out amongst a bunch of users that are using their spare capacity, we can actually store things to like on the order of 10 to the minus 6 a gigabyte or something like that.
And when you model this out, hard drive capacity increases keep pace with the amount of storage that you will add over time?
Yeah, effectively. Like I think being able to add storage to the network will allow us to keep all this data. And I think the data will actually be super valuable, because now you have this 5 years of data of applications and humans interacting, and you can then build applications on top of that, right? And if this goes on like 1,000 years from now or 100 years, you have this data set of like all this economic activity to like a millisecond resolution, like you could in theory start recording every digital event that's happening in the world and just recording when it happened. And that is really cool, right? Like, I think we haven't really scratched the surface of what blockchain can accomplish if it actually is successful, a successful technology.
Yeah, it's interesting to think about how these days so much of these new technologies are reliant upon a high fidelity, large data set, especially with all the machine learning and everything that's going on that space. And I would imagine, like, let's just say an industry like self-driving cars, like the more data you can capture and the larger sample size you have, the better the car is going to drive. And so
I don't think we'll be able to store a self-driving car data.
You don't think so?
that is petabytes of data a day.
Is it really? I had no idea.
Yeah. From like a fleet the size of Tesla, I think it's a really absurd amount.
So how are they doing it? They're just picking like some subset of the data and uploading that?
I think they're probably capturing all of it and then like doing some very clever filtering of like what is redundant based on their models. But yeah, you can't throw away that data because it might be extremely valuable, right? You're trying to build this AI that will drive the car based on all the observations. You don't know
right.
if the stuff you throw away is going to be useful or not. So yeah, there's enormous storage challenges in self-driving cars.
Yeah, I'd love to actually, that's probably a good idea for me to find the appropriate contact at Tesla or something and dig into that topic. That'd be a fun podcast to be sure. Very cool. So how can people get started? If they're like, wow, this sounds like a really awesome project. You got your, alpha network live so people can go kick the tires. Like what can people do to join the community to make sure that they're in kind of at the very, you know, when you really start getting going and ramping this up, if people want to jump on board, when and where do they do that?
So you can go to our site. There's a link to either reach out to us to Telegram or email or I think Reddit as well. And you can reach out to us. There's a Discord group that we do all our development on. We can get you in there. There's a GitHub with a bunch of issues and good first issues. So if you're a Rust programmer or interested in Rust, please check it out. And yeah, our alpha testnet out. If you can knock it down before I fix the bugs, I'll give you a t-shirt, basically.
Amazing.
But yeah, please check. So like ideally, like we'd love to have people engage and actually download the kernel code and see where the bugs are and build tests and, you know, not do experiments. I think this is really kind of the most exciting part of the project because we got it to stand up and it like works. So now we're doing like all the really fun like Byzantine like fault tolerance analysis and writing tests for that and seeing where things fall over. And that, like, I think is effectively, like, you're working on stuff that people are still writing papers about. And that is super exciting for an engineer.
Yeah, absolutely. And how big is your team these days?
We're at 16. So grew pretty fast. Yeah.
That's such a fun size.
Yeah. Yeah. Everybody knows each other. And we're, like, constantly talking. Yeah, it's a super fun size. You can still keep track of what everyone's doing.
Well, I'm excited for you guys. I am going to obviously keep track of all of this stuff and I'm rooting for you because this is certainly, there has been so many times over the course of the last couple of years where I've been really excited about some of these smart contracts and different apps that are being built on top of them only to run into that frustration of really slow transaction times and things falling over. And so it's very apparent that this is a problem and is holding back a lot of, you know, real development that could take place. So it's exciting to see someone tackling it in a new and novel way. So congrats on that. And yeah, I'll be looking forward to seeing this come out in hopefully Q1 of next year.
Cool. Thank you so much. Yeah, thank you for having me. This has been a lot of fun.
All right, that was it for this episode. If you would like to see more episodes of the show, the number one thing you can do to help out to get better guests on the show is to head on over to the iTunes podcast area and give us a 5-star review. That'd be really helpful. And that will get our show recommended to more people, which means more downloads, which means better guests. Also, I do another podcast that you might enjoy. It's actually done more frequently than this one. It's called The Kevin Rose Show. It is about all things life enhancement. Head on over to kevinrose.com and you can see all my latest episodes there. And there will also be links to subscribe. That is it for this episode. I hope you enjoyed it and be well.